I loaded the gun quickly, chambered the round quickly, shot once, missed, shot a second time, hit. I thought that he might have still lived through that somehow, because he was gurgling, so I shot him again and then shoved him down in the ditch.
I'm Emma Kenny, welcome to Bang to Rights, a deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi guys, welcome back to the channel. Honestly, when I researched this case and I looked at the killer, particularly in his interview with the detectives, all I could think about was Pulp Fiction and the character that John Travolta plays, because he literally looks like he's styled himself exactly on that particular hitman. You may disagree with me, but genuinely, it sent shivers down my spine. And also, it's the hairstyle and the way he's coming across with grandiose answers. We will go into that in detail, but it deeply concerns me. Let's talk about the victim in this case, Genaro Sanchez. What an amazing young man. The kind of guy everybody gravitates towards. He's warm, he's open, he's full of life, he's kind, he's enthusiastic, and he's standing right on the brink of his future. In 2012, at just 18 years of age, he's taken those amazing first steps into adulthood. He's beginning his journey at East Central University, and everything is ahead of him. Hope, opportunity, possibility, it's all to play for. But what Genaro couldn't have possibly known, something that no one in fact could have ever anticipated, was that danger was already uncomfortably close. Just down the hall lives another student, a man I would say often dismissed as eccentric, quirky, perhaps even a little bit odd, but ultimately he's considered harmless, or so it seemed. But behind that facade, behind that harmless seeming individual, is something way more disturbing. Because what we're talking about in this case is not some kind of impulsive moment of lack of control. This isn't somebody who suddenly loses the plot. This is an individual who's been harboring the idea of murder. This is a man who wants to understand what it feels like to kill. That's the motivation. And Genaro is going to become the answer to that horrific curiosity. We are talking about one of the most brutal cases of calculated, premeditated murder. And it is devastating to imagine a tale of two cities to some degree. We have this most amazing young man, Genaro Sanchez, who is loved by so many and who is, like I said, full of hope, full of aspiration, full of life. And then we have another individual, literally just doors away, living a completely different life. His concern isn't about success. His concern isn't about wanting to succeed in life. His concern is simply about eradication, erasure. Gerard Murray is about wanting to feel the omnipotence of being God in that moment. Taking a life, removing a much-loved human from this world, and stopping all of that beautiful hope and progression in its tracks. And actually, I think, believing that if he did it well enough, he could probably get away with it, and not just get away with it, actually go ahead and do it again and again and again. Like I said, when I've looked at cases like this before, particularly when I look at interrogations, you can often feel a level of empathy for the individual who's found themselves in that situation where they've taken a life, or you can feel deep frustration, or you can feel anger and rage. But there is something about this guy that makes me feel fear. Genuine fear. Because murderous minds exist, but there is something about this murderous mind that stands out. Genaro Sanchez, the victim in this case, was born on the 7th of August, 1994. He was born in McAlester, Oklahoma. His parents were Gianna Weldrip and Marcos Sanchez. He grew up in Stewart. His mum speaks, of course, as you would imagine, a loving mother to speak about him. But one of the things that she said, he was just one of those really good kids. He's really smart. She said he had no common sense, but he was very bright in other ways. She said he was a goofball. She said he was her drama king. Apparently, he always had a smile on his face. He loved people. People adored him back. He was very easy to love. He was one of those young people who was outgoing. And in the eighth grade, he was nominated into the book for academic achievement because he is very bright. Then in 2012, he graduated from Stuart High School. He then went on to study civil engineering at East Central University, where he was assigned to live in the Pisagie Hall dormitory on campus. Like so many millions of students have been assigned. You go to your dorms, people give them you hope you're going to get on with people. A lot of the time, you get on with some. And you don't get on with everyone. But you know what? It helps to form who you are as a human being. It makes you more diplomatic. It also means that you learn to look after your own pots and pans because at the end of the day, you're not washing anybody else's in the end. But ultimately, it's part and parcel of growing up, isn't it? You go and get on campus, have fun, meet people you like, meet people you don't like. It adds to the rich tapestry of life psychologically, educationally, socially, and even physically. Now, also living in the Pisagie Hall dormitory on the same floor as Gennaro is Gerard Murray. So Gerard Murray was born on July the 20th, 1994 in Asher, Oklahoma. I would say early doors, there are big problems. He reportedly, and I had to revisit this several times to check that I had got this point right. He apparently tried to kill himself when he was 5 years old. Now, his brother discovered him and he did survive the attempt. And I've tried to really focus my mind on my early years work with children. So I specialized with my psychological therapist mostly between the ages of 13 and 25. That was my major cohort. But my initial beginnings of my career, I did work with early years. So they were between 3 and 11. Now, when I look back, I can think of 1 7-year-old that certainly did not wish to be in this world any longer and certainly made attempts to, shall we say, vacate themselves from this universe, very sadly. However, I tried to think back to 5-year-olds and I genuinely cannot remember any 5-year-old expressing any suicidal ideation. Now, I'm not for 1 minute saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying it's incredibly rare. And if a child was expressing suicidal ideation at that age, first of all, I want to know why they even knew about death, because it's very early for them to actually feel that there is ultimately a choice between living and dying. Secondly, I would certainly want to know whether there was any severe trauma or abuse going on at home, which would make them feel so hopeless. Or I'd want to know whether there were any role models who were dealing with their own very serious mental health issues that were role modeling that kind of behavior as far as the child is concerned. But like I said, those things may have existed in his wider world, but nonetheless, irrespective of what I've just talked about, it comes down to the fact that apparently he did try. He just survived it, but nonetheless, it introduces the concept of there being something quite unstable from a really early age where this young man is concerned. He was also badly bullied as a child, which is awful. I mean, to be abandoned and isolated and to feel different from your peers is deeply challenging without then being made to feel terrible for being alive because people don't like you. He was very overweight as a child, and it seems that that was one of the motivations for bullying. Interestingly, about 9 years ago, there was a report that came out where they'd interviewed children between the ages of 5 and 11. So essentially in the UK, 5 to 11 would be primary school. And that's pretty much the entirety of primary school. It can be 4 to 11, but let's just say 5 to 11. And they interviewed kids about the worst thing that they could be called at school, the thing that would isolate and ostracize them most, and they chose fat. That was the thing that worried them most deeply. So he's obviously dealing with that level of rejection. And again, that's really challenging. Equally, sometimes kids avoid other kids or have conflict with other kids because there is something odd about them. There is something about their behavior that makes them want to give them a wide berth. But that's a kid. They don't understand why you're giving a wide berth. They just feel angry about it. So it could be that there is a, shall we say, insight into the type of character he is early on that makes other children not like him. He's described by people who knew him as reclusive, intelligent, odd, always quirky and a little different. So there's an eccentricity about his nature, but for the most part, that bodes well because even though it's quite challenging at school to be somebody who's an individual and unique, as you get older, that really plays well for you. They're the individuals that most of us aspire to be like because they're just okay being themselves. Now, he is known for always wearing the same black suit. And in his interviews with the police after the murder I'm going to talk about today, he genuinely is dressed exactly like the assassins in Pulp Fiction. Genuinely. I am telling you now, it is like looking at somebody who styled themselves that specific way. And we have to ask ourselves, why? Why is he dressed like a man in black? Why is he dressed like a individual out of Pulp Fiction? I'm not saying he styled himself on that, but it does kind of speak to me that he must have been looking in that direction. Now, Gennaro, he had met Murray when they played video games together. They had both been in the room of a mutual friend. That's how they connect. And I will tell you that when his classmates were actually asked about this guy, quite a lot of his classmates said that he was creepy. And I can completely understand why. First of all, just going to throw it out there, guys. I am somebody who believes that unique quirkiness is amazing. I have never been a fashionable person because I have no fashion sense. I'm highly dyslexic. I'm very disorganized regarding what I wear. I just put on generally some kind of jumpsuit or a t-shirt and some comfy bottoms because all that bothers me is being comfortable. I have also had friends who dress like they come from 1840 and are in some kind of gothic movie, and they wear velvet and lace and they look incredible. But let me tell you, if we were hanging out playing video games and they were wearing that, I'd be like, I'm going to have to lend you some clothes because you're actually making me feel anxious. You're making me feel anxiety because you look uncomfortable in that corset. That would be a normal response for most of us. So if the guy is always wearing a suit, I'd be like, get out of that suit and put on some jogging bottoms. You know, we don't need to be gaming whilst you literally look like a hitman. It's not appropriate, not even if we're playing the game Hitman. So that's odd. But again, maybe people aren't as confident as I am at challenging that kind of wear when you're just chilling out. But I do understand why they would find him odd, because most of us don't want to ever wear a suit. We have to be forced into it for our jobs or for weddings. We're not doing it of our own volition at 18 years of age. Now, on October the 3rd, 2012, Gennaro had actually been playing Mario Kart with Murray and with another two students. One of these was Wyatt Freeman. Now, Murray had told Freeman that he didn't think he could make him tap out with a chokehold. So obviously we're talking about someone now who's going to faint because they've been choked and they have to tap to let that person know, okay, enough, I'm going to go unconscious. So at this point, Freeman puts Murray in a chokehold and apparently immediately passed out and hit the floor. So Freeman must have been quite strong to do that. And I would imagine that Murray didn't actually believe that that was going to be a possibility. And that's going to be challenging, isn't it? Because if you're a young man and you find yourself in a situation where somebody's overpowered you and you didn't think it was going to happen, you're going to feel a level of humiliation. It just goes with the territory. Some people will just laugh it off. Some people will just be pissed off. And when he comes around, they end up getting into an argument. And Murray ends up punching Freeman in the temple and also spits on him. Now, you know what? If you can't deal with the activity you've suggested, then don't activity suggest. At the end of the day, you have said, I don't think you can choke me out. Maybe I can choke you out. We've got into a situation where Freeman's gone ahead, done what they agreed to do. He's got choked out, and now Murray is angry. And instead of just taking it on the nose and acknowledging he put himself in that position, he's just infuriated. So spitting on him shows that he's just absolutely incensed. It's so disrespectful to do that. And it got so bad that the university police were actually called, and Gennaro did give a statement and he agreed with Freeman's story. So obviously in this scenario, if it looks like Freeman just went out of his way to choke somebody out with no reason, that could cause him to get thrown out of university. But in fact, Gennaro's saying, no, this was Murray's idea. And therefore he is stood by another friend, but also acknowledged that it was bad what happened to Murray. He said that he'd convulsed on the floor after that chokehold, and then that apparently Murray had said that he'd got memory loss due to the lack of oxygen. And then Gennaro said that Wyatt, the other friend who was there, had insisted that Gerard was full of it. So it's got really escalated. Now, the police report stated that Freeman wanted Murray moved out of the dorm, or at least away from his room. So clearly the boys did not feel very safe around this man. They felt like there was something problematic about him and that he was going to resent what had occurred and maybe ruminate on that and fester on that and want retribution for that. And this lad actually said he was concerned that Gerard Murray may try to blow him up. And I find that deeply concerning because aside from the fact that this boy feels this way because there's a book that Murray keeps in his room, which is called The Anarchist Manual, it says something about his concern of impact possibility. Because he's basically suggesting this kind of kid could be a school shooter, could be somebody who would blow things up and could actually blow people up. Most of us can get into scenarios where there is conflict and we escalate and we can do things and say things that we regret. But the idea then of walking away from that situation and thinking that other person might want to kill me, that's not the position that most of our heads ever go to. We might feel they might not want to speak to us. They might feel really angry with us. There might be a period of isolation from them. But we don't think, oh, they might kill us. They might blow us up. Again, that's an instinctual response. There's something that boy is seeing about this man's potential and bringing that to fruition by telling the police. But of course, the police are just dealing with that altercation. They deal with these things all the time. They're probably not taking it that seriously. Now we get to December the 5th, 2012. This is around 9 p.m. and they're in the dorms. Gerard Murray goes into Gennaro's room and says, listen, will you drive me to Walmart? He offers him $20 in exchange as petrol money, which obviously when you're a student, $20 is quite a lot of money. Fuel in America was at least reasonable. I'm sure now with the way things are in our world with wars going on, that might not be the case. But $20 for a quick run to Walmart, it's probably quite a nice idea to take that cash. And also he's thinking, let's just put to rest what went on between us. Because he was involved in that situation. He wasn't an active party in the chokehold, but he was there when it played out. And he feels like there might be some issues between him and between Murray. So he agrees. They get into Gennaro's pickup truck and he drives to Walmart in Ada. However, when they get to the car park, Gerard Murray pulls out a gun and then demands that he drives into Asher. Now imagine being Gennaro. He already knows that this guy is harboring horrible resentment from what's played out. He already knows that he has concerns about the kind of boy that he is and the kind of potential he has. And now he's literally got a gun. He's in a car with him and is being demanded to drive elsewhere. Now, Gennaro panics. At this point, immediately begs for his life. I mean, that in itself tells you something. Because if I was in a car with a guy that I'd hung out with before, albeit there'd been some kind of issues, and he pulled a gun out, I'd be like, what the are you doing with that? What are you doing with that? Put that away, you absolute weirdo. That would be my response. I wouldn't be thinking, oh my God, he's going to kill me. The very fact that that immediacy of response is, please don't kill me, means that he genuinely thinks that Gerard Murray has that potential. He also grabs his phone because he's obviously thinking, I need help, but Gerard Murray takes it off him. So now Gennaro is thinking to himself, oh my God, he's armed. I haven't even got a way of calling help. So what can he do? He starts to drive. Now, at this point, he's really nervous, so his driving probably isn't articulated in the way that it would be normally. So Gerard Murray unloads the gun and then gives him the bullets to make him feel more comfortable, which it would. Of course it would. Oh my God, I thought he was going to shoot me. He's giving me the bullets. It's going to be fine. I'm nervous, but at least I've got control of the ammunition, the things that can actually do the damage. But Gennaro doesn't know that Murray's got a second magazine. Think about that. He's really planned this. He's recognized that that might be the response. This guy might panic. This guy might try to get help. This guy might crash the car, might do anything to prevent me putting his life at risk. So he thought, I'll calm him down. I'll bring a second magazine. So when he acts in a way that could cause me an issue with my plan, I'll give him the bullets and he'll feel at peace. Then on the journey, they talk about their upbringings, their families, their pasts. Now, for Gennaro, that would be really important because at the end of the day, he has to make it seem that he is a human being with families and friends and a past and a future. Because it is true that when you're in a dangerous situation with a perpetrator, particularly somebody who's got power and control over whether you live or die, the more you humanize yourself, the more likely it is that you will survive. Not in all cases. Psychopathic murderers, serial killers, for example, they really don't care. I mean, they'll listen to you, they'll hear all that, but for the most part, they'll just go down their own route. They'll do whatever it is they want to do. But Gennaro is doing the right thing, trying to humanize himself, trying to relate to this guy, trying to show similarities and connection, because that makes it more difficult if ultimately he decides to harm him. And during this period of time when they're talking to each other, Gerard Murray is literally reassuring Gennaro that he isn't going to hurt him. It's going to be okay. Now, eventually, they turn off a main road, and then Murray asks Gennaro to turn down a dirt road. I don't even want to imagine where Gennaro's head was in this moment, because he must have had a sneaking suspicion or a dawning realization or a really terrifying understanding that this could be the last journey he ever took. Murray quickly loads the gun with the second magazine, fires. The bullet misses. Imagine Gennaro in that moment, realizing that all of his fears have come to fruition, knowing that the bullet has missed, but that he's armed with others. Murray fires a second time, hits Gennaro in the head. Then Murray gets out of the car, which continues at this point, slowly rolling, and hits a tree. He then pulls Gennaro out of the car. Gennaro's gurgling, he's not dead. So he fires another bullet into his head. And then he just shoves this incalculably important human being in a ditch. Then he drops Gennaro's phone somewhere down near his body. After he's killed this young man who had so much going for him, who just got in a car thinking to get $20 to go to Walmart and that he'd settle a dispute that had occurred, hope that maybe he could paper over any cracks in the relationship. And instead now, he's literally been executed in his own car. He feebly tries to cover him with leaves and a stick. And then he goes back to Gennaro's pickup truck and he tries to move it, but it's stuck. One of the wheels was actually off the ground, so there's no traction. And then at that point, he looks to where he'd left Gennaro's body and he realizes he can still actually see his shirt. So he's got his car that's stuck and he's got the body of the car's owner literally visible. So he then goes and tries to do a better cover-up job. As he is attempting to do this, he sees headlights. So at that point, he runs over to the truck, he waves, he tells the man that he'd nodded off of the wheel and crashed and that he couldn't get the truck unstuck. So he is thinking on his feet. That is a credible story. It's a plausible story. People do that. And obviously, the guy's going to feel sorry for him. So the guy gives him a lift to Asher and at this point is dropped off at his grandparents' house. Now, once at that house, he calls his roommate Shane. He informs him that he's been in an accident and basically says, look, can you help me get out of a ditch? He also tells Shane, interestingly though, that he had completed Objective A. So what does Shane think of Objective A? Because it seems to me as if Shane would understand what that was, because clearly there has been some discussion about what Objective A stands for. Now, Shane rings his dad. His dad lives in Asher and says, Dad, could you help? But it turns out his dad's asleep, so he doesn't answer. So Murray then takes it on himself to walk to Shane's parents' house before actually returning to the crime scene and then walking along the highway. This is not a young man who's panicking, is it? There's just some cold calculation to what he's doing. He's got a problem, think of a solution. He's got an action, there'll be a consequence. And he's thinking about how, literally, to get away with murder or to escape justice to some degree. Now, on December the 6th, this is the following day, not long after the murder, Gerard Murray is found walking along the US Route 177 that actually connects South Haven, Kansas, with Madill, Oklahoma. And reportedly, at this point, he'd been trying to hitchhike to Canada and he'd flagged down a car that ended up being a police car. So probably not the best car to flag down, though I do like a bit of divine intervention, you know? Just going to try and hitch to Canada. Oh, this looks like a nice... Oh, the stopping, brilliant. Is it okay? Oh, you're a police officer. Oh, it's not going to end well for me, is it? But anyway, that's what happens. Doesn't realise it's a patrol car. But when the officer gets out, he tells him, I'm the one you're looking for. Now, don't get me wrong. By this point, the police had been alerted to Gennaro's body. But the fact that he says, I'm the one you're looking for, this guy's a police officer. At the end of the day, he's going to arrest you because I'm sure they're looking for quite a few people. I mean, it could be for anything that you're pleading guilty to in this moment. So that's going to ultimately mean you're going to the station, even if it was a DUI you were being charged with, or you had some warrant out for a misdemeanor. The point is saying, I'm the one you're looking for, it's deeply incriminating, even if you haven't admitted what they're looking for at all. Now, Murray at this point is brought back to the station. He's interviewed, as we would expect, and it is absolutely chilling. This guy is chilling to the core. He confesses to the murder. He answers all the questions very openly. When you listen to his voice, I would say it is very measured. I would say, whilst obviously under no circumstances am I diagnosing him as being on the spectrum, he does seem to speak in a way that suggests he could be at the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. Of course, that isn't for 1 minute suggesting that people who are autistic would ever engage in any murder at all. But it is possible to have murderers who are born who also are autistic. And just the way he expresses himself, it reminds me of certain individuals I've worked with in the past. But like I said, this is just my personal opinion. It's not actually evidenced. And I am very sure that there'll be other reasons why he could come across this way. He also said during this interview that he wanted to know what it felt like to kill someone, that he'd been planning to kill someone for about 3 weeks. He made it clear that Gennaro had done nothing to him and that he had intended to kill him, but that he was just the person he'd decided on. There was no backdrop to this murder, no plan because he deserved his retribution. It was much more of a, he's available, he's accessible, I want to kill someone, it's going to be him. He also said that the plan to go to Walmart was an absolute ruse. He'd never intended to go to Walmart. It was just about getting him in the car. He'd also picked out the location where he'd commit the murder about a week before. It's an area that he was really familiar with. He knew the surroundings. He said that he was planning to take him out into the country and to kill him. He'd actually chosen Gennaro as the victim 3 days earlier in particular because he felt like he didn't have a lot of close friends. He felt that his presence would be less noticed, which again is just so ludicrous. The idea that somebody hasn't got a group of people who are constantly present with them, that that means they don't have friends, that makes no sense. A lot of people have friends online. A lot of people have friends who live in different places and spaces. They keep in contact constantly. And they have family who notice immediately when they've disappeared. But that's the way he's calculated it. And again, it shows a lack of nuance emotionally. He hasn't done the maths in that way. He thinks if you are somebody who's very popular, people notice immediately. Actually, that can work against the popular people because everyone thinks that they'll be with somebody else. So when somebody who doesn't go out loads and hasn't got a ton of people around them just disappears, people recognize they've disappeared. But he said the thought just popped into his head that he'd tried a couple of days before to get him into the pickup truck, but Gennaro hadn't been in his room at that point. And he also said that he had had thoughts about ending his own life. It's a shame he didn't take that option. I know that sounds really awful, but with respect, I think that his life, he had a choice to take his own. It's as simple as that. It's his life. If he has made that ultimately very sad decision, and one I wish no one would ever take, but ultimately that's within his control. If he'd done that, Gennaro would have carried on with his own world and his own life and had a future that he deserved and one that he valued. Whereas it seems like Murray doesn't really value life at all. He also mentioned that he wasn't aware that Gennaro had a girlfriend until he'd seen texts on his phone whilst they were driving. And the officer said, listen, this girlfriend is going to be heartbroken. He says, how's that going to make you feel knowing that you've broken this girl's heart? And he said, no differently, sir. Murray also said that he thought the man who'd pulled over to help him would have been suspicious of him at the time because he had no business being on that road. Interesting how Gerard Murray thinks, because for most part, if you are on a road and you see a car that's gone off the tracks or hit a tree, you're not going to be suspicious of someone when they say, I fell asleep at the wheel. Makes absolute sense. People do that all the time. But the very fact that he's imagining that people are viewing him with suspicion speaks more about his suspicious mind himself. Like, he knows his actions. He knows the kind of devious thoughts that he has. So he imagines other people can see, feel, and hear those thoughts. He also tells the officers that he'd taken a can of WD-40 from Shane's parents' house because he wanted to use it on the car to remove his fingerprints. Again, this is about concealment. This is about after the fact. Yeah, it's gone horribly wrong, obviously, because there's a body just yards from where the car that belongs to that body is positioned. And the car obviously is a problem because it relates back to the individual who owns it, who's been murdered, as I said, who's now close to the car. He will have been seen with that person on CCTV in different places, so it's clear he was with him, and the car is still in situ. So he's got to move that car, or he's at least got to disguise what his presence in that car has been. And the very fact that he knows how to get rid of those fingerprints, the fact that he wants to remove any incriminating evidence, that means that even though, like I said, it's gone horribly wrong, he's still trying to conceal his involvement. And the reason I'm saying that is, that doesn't sound like somebody who's completely insane. It doesn't sound like somebody who's completely lost his mind. It sounds like somebody who's unbelievably manipulative. Now, he said that he found that can of WD-40 in the garden. So that's initially what he says about how he found it, just this convenient WD-40 that's going to be useful in removing his fingerprints. Now, when he goes back to the car, he realizes as he's getting closer that he hears someone cough. So apparently he stays in the wooded area that he'd been walking through. And he thought that the man who gave him a lift to his grandparents' house might have gone back to the scene. And he knew, of course, that he hadn't hidden Gennaro's body well. So he ended up not going back to the car. However, the officer then learns that Shane's stepfather had actually woken up. So his best friend's stepfather had woken up and had actually given him the can of WD-40, and had also apparently given him a lift to an abandoned house not far from the scene of the crime, and that's where Murray had walked from. Now, the officer told Murray that he believed he had been honest with him, but said, I know for a fact you didn't get the can of WD-40 from the front yard. Gerard Murray immediately admitted, you're right, and said that Shane's stepfather had given it to him, but apparently he hadn't said this earlier because he wanted to keep him out of this. He also said that he'd told Shane's stepfather what he'd done. And we've only got his word for that, but nonetheless, he's now admitting that he told Shane's stepfather that he had done something terrible, and nonetheless, Shane's stepfather had given him the WD-40. Now, the officer also told Gerard Murray that there was a note left on the window of the car saying, come to the house at the end of the road, but Murray said he didn't write that note and that it wasn't there when he left the scene. He also told the officer that he was really surprised that he was found so quickly. He thought he had 6 to 8 hours. He'd hoped that investigators would think he was headed towards Mexico rather than Canada because Mexico was closer. And he's being so factual in these answers. There's just no emotion there whatsoever. It's like he's doing an interview and he's just completely at peace and he's just saying whatever he thinks to say in the moment without much thought or fear. He just seems to be able to hold what he has done without horror or conscience. Now, when he's asked if he felt any remorse, he said he was sad when he got caught so quickly. So I don't feel that was where the officer was going. I think he was asking about actual remorse on a conscience level. You know, you've killed someone. He's like, no, I'm just sad I got caught.
I'm sad that I got caught so quickly.
He also tells the detective that he'd stolen the gun 2 weeks earlier from a man named Daniel Davis. And during the interview, the officer actually says to him, you know, you've done a terrible thing tonight. You've killed a young man just for the simple fact of, let's just say, for you. Murray responded, yes, sir. The officer then asks him, what do you think should happen to you? And Murray answers, death sentence, sir. He's asked, why do you think you deserve the death sentence? And he said, an eye for an eye, sir. Which is very biblical, but it's actually inaccurate context-wise. So for example, if somebody killed my father, an eye for an eye would say that I could kill their father. It isn't the person who kills that is the eye for the eye scenario. It is the equivalent is killed. So in this case, it could be he kills somebody's friend and then somebody kills his friend. Sorry, I don't know why I'm going on about this. You probably all know that, but it's one of those statements that often people misinterpret. But nonetheless, he's basically saying, I took a life, so my life needs to be taken. Now, on December the 12th, 2012, the very sad funeral of Gennaro was held at the Harold Leister Gymnasium in Stuart. Hundreds of people attended, hundreds. So when it comes down to Gerard Murray thinking that this guy wasn't popular and didn't have a lot of friends, he was wrong. His obituary read, G loved his family, friends and life. He was a very outgoing, fun-loving guy, full of life. He had so many hopes and dreams and was absolutely determined to make a difference. G enjoyed going to the movies, especially movie time with his dad, and listening to music. Johnny Bravo was his hero. He would spend at least one night a week with his nonny. I'm going to assume we're talking about his grandma. He enjoyed watching ball games with the Harrises, but hated feeding the cows. And a sign was later installed in the area where his body was found, which read, dedicated in loving memory of Gennaro Sanchez, awesome son, brother and friend, August 4th, 1994 to December the 5th, 2012. It's just devastating when you think about the dash, isn't it? 1994 to 2012, so young he was. When Gennaro's mother Gina was asked why she thought he agreed to give Murray a lift to the shop, she said, because my son saw the good in everybody. When Gerard asked for the ride, he saw an olive branch being extended to him and he thought, okay, bygones are going to be bygones and we're going to start fresh. As the case was heading towards trial, prosecutor Richard Smotherman announced that he would be seeking the death penalty. It was believed that Murray, in fact, could have been intending to commit more murders because he'd actually told his roommate Shane that he'd reached objective A. So the prosecution is indicating potentially there were more objectives to achieve. He'd also told Shane around 2 weeks before the murder that he needed some ammunition. Such a shame that Shane didn't go and speak to anybody about this. Again, this is where people believe that an individual who is literally telling them their plans isn't actually telling the truth. It is far better to imagine the worst and to act on the information they are giving you than to hold back because you don't want to upset them, even if you're afraid of them, than to wait for these kind of scenarios to unfold, because in this case, it was deadly. Now, his room was searched, and at this point, items were seized, including laptops, but with respect, nothing was ever reported about further notable evidence being discovered. It could be, for example, objective A was murder somebody, and objective B was escape, objective C was form a new life. You don't know where the objectives were, but this is what the prosecution believed, that more bodies could have piled up. And in August 2013, Murray was determined to be competent to stand trial. So they say he's well enough to do this, and he actually waives his preliminary hearing. However, in 2015, a hearing takes place, and it's found that Murray is not guilty by reason of insanity. So at this point, it meant the case never reached a jury trial. Now, Judge Canavan said to Gennaro's family, I empathise with you, and I just wish there was something else I could do. Now, the decision was based on the opinion of psychological experts. In one report, psychologist Sean Robertson wrote this. Mr. Murray detailed extensive grandiose and delusional beliefs. Although he knew that it was illegal and he haphazardly tried to evade authorities, he conveyed that he came to believe that it was required that he must kill someone. He eventually chose the victim in this case based upon his perceptions of that victim's role in the world. A world in which Mr. Murray viewed himself as the king. He believed it was fate or it would not ever have occurred. It was also said that he suffers from a severe mental illness, either a bipolar disorder or a schizoaffective disorder bipolar type. So when we're talking about schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type is a chronic mental health condition. It combines schizophrenia symptoms, psychosis, hallucinations, delusions, with significant mood episodes, specifically mania and often depression. Then another psychologist, Therese Hall, she said he was grandiose and had bragged to her about inventing a new energy source that would apparently make him rich. Now, when we talk about grandiose delusions, we're talking about false beliefs about inflated power and knowledge and skills and self-worth. So people will hold these beliefs in the state even when there is absolute contrary evidence. So mental health, this term basically refers to a state that occurs in bipolar disorder during periods of extreme mood elevation. This is known as hypomanic and manic episodes. Grandiose delusions occur in over 60% of those people diagnosed with bipolar. Then you can have grandiose delusions that can occur in psychotic disorders. So around half of those diagnosed with schizophrenia will exhibit grandiosity. Then other types of delusions can occur also in those conditions, so delusions of persecution, etc. Now, grandiosity also occurs in personality conditions such as narcissistic personality disorder. And when you think about personality disorders, they involve ways of thinking, feeling, behaving that basically significantly deviate from what we would consider normal in the culture we belong to. So people with NPD are highly self-absorbed and highly egotistical to literally the point where they believe these things about themselves that mean that their lives end up being severely affected. So it could be he's got the mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar, etc., schizoaffective disorder, which includes both. It could be that he's also got narcissistic personality disorder. He certainly comes across as highly narcissistic, in my opinion. Now, she said his explanation of his thinking at the time is quite irrational. He explains he thought he was receiving stage directions, that a life had to be taken. Apparently, he would meditate and the thought of death would come to him and that would make him feel light and good, which is a little bit dark and twisted, in my opinion. Now, at the time of the events of December the 6th, 2012, she said that Mr. Murray was suffering from an untreated mental illness characterized by serious mood and psychotic symptoms. He had delusions of being directed to kill someone, and he had told a friend that he could talk to ghosts. So because of this, Gerard Murray was sent to a mental hospital, the Oklahoma Forensic Center in Vinita. This is where he would then be fully assessed. Now, District Attorney Richard Smotherman said, "You will never convince me that this man is not a danger to society today, tomorrow, 5 years from now, 50 years from now." He said, "This was the most chilling confession I've ever seen in 25 years of doing this job. When I watched his confession the night of the murder, it scared the hell out of me because there was nothing but a blank look in his eyes as he answered the questions. If ever a case demanded the attention of the legislator, this is it. Because what happened in that courtroom reeks of injustice." Now, on October the 14th, 2015, Peter Rausch, who's a psychologist, determined that Gerard Murray was not displaying any signs of mental illness. In his report, which had been written the previous month, he said that although he had some odd ideas, he would not say that they were delusional beliefs as far as he was concerned. However, Joseph Errico, a psychiatrist, said that Murray's treatment at the hospital should continue. His opinion was that he had a history of mental illness, and as far as he was concerned, he was still displaying symptoms. So he believed that Murray was experiencing either a bipolar mood disorder with psychotic symptoms or a combination of schizophrenia symptoms and a mood disorder such as mania or depression. So as a result of this, a judge ordered that two further experts should assess Murray to determine his mental state, who both determined that he was indeed a danger. Now, Sean Robertson, they said that he couldn't rule out the possibility of further violence if Murray was released. I think we all agree, goes without saying. So the judge at this point ruled that he was still in need of treatment. I mean, it's harrowing to imagine that people could potentially want him released after what he's done anyway. Now, we get to 2016, and at this point, a bill is passed in Oklahoma which modifies the not guilty by reason of insanity defense. It's called Senate Bill 1214. So this removed the traditional insanity defense and provided new verdicts of either guilty with mental defect or not guilty by reason of mental illness. A mental health evaluation has to be carried out in both of those verdicts. Now, if someone is found guilty with mental defect, they would have to serve a normal sentence in prison. So this basically brings in the opportunity for harsher sentencing than the previous not guilty by reason of insanity defense. It means they're now able to be found insane, but also able to be found guilty of a crime, which makes sense. Now, it also adds a restriction when those diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder that significantly contributed to the offense can't use the not guilty by reason of insanity defense. That makes sense. If this person has antisocial personality disorder, so think about psychopaths, even if they were apparently insane at the time, it's the antisocial personality disorder that's a big problem when they've gone so far as to kill, that means that they're likely not going to be safe if they are freed. So again, that's a very pivotal decree, essentially. Now, Richard Smotherman, They requested the bill, and the reason for that is it was literally created as a result of Gennaro's murder. And the lack of justice, which came as a result of the not guilty by reason of insanity verdict in the case. Some of them said, this bill targets the most dangerous criminals who have mental illnesses but will never be cured by treatment. The ones that kill just to kill or hurt others because they get pleasure from it. So this bill would allow a jury to send those criminals to prison rather than to a mental hospital, which is where, as far as Smotherson is concerned, they deserve to be. So that came into effect from November the 1st, 2016. Problem is, of course, that he was tried before that. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity before this bill was passed, so it doesn't stand for him. Now, in 2017, a hearing was held because Gerard Murray had asked that he be released to less restrictive care. I kid you not. How harrowing for the victim's family. Judge John Canavan heard the evidence and then concluded that Murray was still a threat to society, which he clearly will always be. The judge said he's still mentally ill, and in the opinion of some of the physicians, he's worse than he was before when he gets off his meds. I mean, that's harrowing, isn't it? He's had loads of treatment, but if he gets off his meds, he's worse than he was when he came in. The judge went on to say, and when you're the most dangerous patient out of 200, I find... The court finds that he is a danger to himself and others. He's in the least restrictive setting that I'm willing to give him at this time, and I would deny any motion on his part to remove him from where he is at the present time. Other statements he's made that concern the court were that he doesn't know when he might hurt someone again, which chills the court to the extent that it's a possibility he contemplates in his own mind, hurting someone else. The judge noted that although Gerard Murray seemed to improve when he's on medications, he gets worse when he stops taking those medications, and he believes that Murray would fully intend to stop taking the medications if he was left to his own accord. Now, it's also heard that 5 days prior to the hearing, Gerard Murray had actually been found to have a 5-inch knife blade in his possession. I mean, that in itself tells you the guy's learnt nothing and he's still a massive danger. Now, after the hearing, District Attorney Richard Smotherman commented, Gerard Murray is a frightening individual. If released, he will kill again. Of this, I have no doubt. Now, in 2020, a staff medical evaluation of Murray read, Mr. Murray has been in the NGRI program for 5 years. During the course of his hospitalization, he has manifested symptoms of hostility and paranoia. He has an odd, overly formal social presentation, entitlement and rigid thinking with rationalization, intellectualization and some obsessions. His attitude is often condescending. At one point, his treatment shifted from stabilizing his mood to addressing his rigid thought pattern. Mr. Murray's condition changed for the worse this past year. There have been several incidents of concern regarding physical aggression. On the 29th of the 11th, 19, Mr. Murray punched a peer multiple times and was subsequently placed on unit restriction for 30 days. On the 2nd of the 12th, 2019, Mr. Murray hit his head several times on the headboard of his bed. He was placed on close observations for aggression and self-harm. On the 5th of the 12th, 2019, Mr. Murray hit his head multiple times on the nurse's desk. Now we get to 2022. Apparently, Gerard Murray has reportedly been allowed to have supervised day release for treatment programs outside of the hospital, which, as far as I'm concerned, is absolutely terrifying. Gerard Murray is a narcissist. I am really surprised that he hasn't been diagnosed with NPD. Maybe he has. Maybe that's what they're referring to superiority-wise in the fact that he is condescending to people, that he intellectualizes, he's got an explanation for everything. So even when you try to challenge him therapeutically, he's not going to listen because obviously he's far more superior than you or I are. Whatever is going on in the psychiatric units, I think it's amazing that he's being allowed to go to other treatment programs. And I do worry that one day some overinflated ego of a psychiatric professional will make the choice to release him because they think they've done such good work with him. That would just be harrowing beyond belief. This guy needs to spend the rest of his life in a secure facility. That's the only way we can truly prevent other victims happening. If they let him go, he's going to repeat this action. If they let him go, there'll be more and more potential Gennaros. And that is harrowing to imagine. I can't believe that that poor family have not really got justice. I'm glad the law has changed. I'm glad that now they've got those points that mean that people who do the things that this man did to that poor victim will be held accountable in a much stronger way. But right now, there is a possibility that Jared Murray will one day walk free. And that genuinely beggars belief. Are you scared that this kind of individual might get out? Do you feel hopeful that with the right treatment, he could no longer be a danger? Or do you feel like me, that one day someone will stamp that approval and then another victim will be found? Or even worse, multiple victims. I'll see you again next time, guys. Look after yourself. Take care. Be safe.